Just as these considerations would lead us to expect, we find that this work of helping on the astral and lower mental planes is chiefly in the hands of the pupils of the masters. Men who, though yet far from the attainment of adeptship, have evolved themselves to the extent of being able to function consciously upon the planes in question. Some of these have taken the further step of completing the links between the physical consciousness and that of the higher levels, and they therefore have the undoubted advantage of recollecting in waking life what they have done and what they have learnt in those other worlds, but there are many others who, though as yet unable to carry their consciousness through unbroken, are nevertheless by no means wasting the hours when they think they are asleep, but spending them in noble and unselfish labor for their fellow men. What this labor is we will proceed to consider, but before we enter upon that part of the subject we will refer to an objection which is very frequently brought forward with regard to such work, and we will also dispose of the comparatively rare cases in which the agents are either nature spirits or men who have cast off the physical body. People whose grasp of theosophical ideas is as yet imperfect are often in doubt as to whether it is allowable for them to try to help someone whom they find in sorrow or difficulty, lest they should interfere with the fate which has been decreed for him by the absolute justice of the eternal law of karma. The man is in his present position, they say in effect, because he has deserved it, he is now working out the perfectly natural result of some evil which he has committed in the past. What right have I to interfere with the action of the great cosmic law by trying to ameliorate his condition, either on the astral plane or the physical? Now the good people who make such suggestions are really, however unconsciously to themselves, exhibiting the most colossal conceit, for their position implies two astounding assumptions. First, that they know exactly what another man's karma has been, and how long it has decreed that his sufferings shall last, and secondly, that they, the insects of a day, could absolutely override the cosmic law and prevent the due working out of karma by any action of theirs. We may be well assured that the great karmic deities are perfectly well able to manage their business without our assistance, and we need have no fear that any steps we may take can by any possibility cause them the slightest difficulty or uneasiness. If a man's karma is such that he cannot be helped, then all our well-meant efforts in that direction will fail, though we shall nevertheless have gained good karma for ourselves by making them. What the man's karma has been is no business of ours. Our duty is to give help to the utmost of our power, and our right is only to the act. The result is in other and higher hands. How can we tell how a man's account stands? For all we know, he may just have exhausted his evil karma, and be at this moment at the very point where a helping hand is needed to give relief and raise him out of his trouble or depression. Why should not we have the pleasure and privilege of doing that good deed as well as another? If we can help him, then that fact of itself shows that he has deserved to be helped, but we can never know unless we try. In any case, the law of karma will take care of itself, and we need not trouble ourselves about it. The cases in which assistance is given to mankind by nature spirits are few. The majority of such creatures shun the haunts of man, and retire before him, disliking his emanations and the perpetual bustle and unrest which he creates all around him. Also, except some of their higher orders, they are generally inconsequent and thoughtless, more like happy children at play under exceedingly favorable physical conditions than like grave and responsible entities. Still, it sometimes happens that one of them will become attached to a human being, and do him many a good turn, but at the present stage of its evolution this department of nature cannot be relied upon for anything like steady cooperation in the work of invisible helpers. For a fuller account of the nature spirits the reader is referred to the fifth of our Theosophical Manuals. Again, help is sometimes given by those recently departed, those who are still lingering on the astral plane, and still in close touch with earthly affairs, as, probably, in the above-mentioned case of the mother who saved her children from falling down a well. But it will readily be seen that the amount of such help available must naturally be exceedingly limited. The more unselfish and helpful a person is, the less likely is he to be found after death lingering in full consciousness on the lower levels of the astral plane, from which the earth is most readily accessible. In any case, unless he were an exceptionally bad man, his stay within the realm whence alone any interference would be possible would be comparatively short, and although from the heaven world he may still shed benign influence upon those whom he has loved on earth, it will usually be rather of the nature of a general benediction than a force capable of bringing about definite results in a specific case, such as those which we have been considering. Again, many of the departed who wish to help those whom they left behind, find themselves quite unable to influence them in any way, since to work from one plane upon an entity on another requires either very great sensitiveness on the part of that entity, or a certain amount of knowledge and skill on the part of the operator. Therefore, although instances of apparitions shortly after death are by no means uncommon, it is rare to find one in which the departed person has really done anything useful, or succeeded in impressing what he wished upon the friend or relation whom he visited. There are such cases, of course, a good many of them when we come to put them all together, but they are not numerous compared to the great number of ghosts who have succeeded in showing themselves. So that but little help is usually given by the dead. Indeed, as will presently be explained, it is far more common for them to be themselves in need of assistance than to be able to accord it to others. At present, therefore, the main bulk of the work which has to be done along these lines falls to the share of those living persons who are able to function consciously on the astral plane. Chapter 5. The Reality of Superphysical Life. It seems difficult for those who are accustomed only to the ordinary and somewhat materialistic lines of thought of the 19th century, to believe in and realize fully a condition of perfect consciousness apart from the physical body. Every Christian, at any rate, is bound by the very foundations of his creed to believe that he possesses a soul, but if you suggest to him the possibility that that soul may be a sufficiently real thing to become visible under certain conditions apart from the body either during life or after death, the chances are 10-to-1 that he will scornfully tell you that he does not believe in ghosts, and that such an idea is nothing but an anachronistic survival of an exploded medieval superstition. If, therefore, we are at all to comprehend the work of the band of invisible helpers, and perchance ourselves to learn to assist in it, we must shake ourselves free from the trammels of contemporary thought on these subjects, and endeavor to grasp the great truth, now a demonstrated fact to many among us, that the physical body is in simple truth nothing but a vehicle or vesture of the real man. It is put off permanently at death, but it is also put off temporarily every night when we go to sleep. Indeed, the process of falling asleep consists in this very action of the real man in his astral vehicle slipping out of the physical body. Again I repeat, this is no mere hypothesis or ingenious supposition. There are many among us who are able to perform, and do perform every day of their lives, this elementary act of magic in full consciousness, who pass from one plane to the other at will, and if that is clearly realized, it will become apparent how grotesquely absurd to them must appear the ordinary unreasoning assertion that such a thing is utterly impossible. It is like telling a man that it is impossible for him to fall asleep, and that if he thinks he has ever done so he is under a hallucination. Now the man who has not yet developed the link between the astral and physical consciousness is unable to leave his denser body at will, or to recollect most of what happens to him while away from it, but the fact nevertheless remains that he leaves it every time he sleeps, and may be seen by any trained clairvoyant either hovering over it or wandering about at a greater or less distance from it, as the case may be. The entirely undeveloped person usually floats close above his physical body, scarcely less asleep than it is, and comparatively shapeless and inchoate, and it is found that he cannot be drawn away from the immediate neighborhood of that physical body without causing serious discomfort which would in fact awaken it. As the man evolves, however, his astral body grows more definite and more conscious, and so becomes a fitter vehicle for him. In the case of the majority of intelligent and cultured people, the degree of consciousness is already very considerable, and a man who is at all spiritually developed is as fully himself in that vehicle as in this denser body. But though he may be fully conscious on the astral plane during sleep, and able to move about on it freely if he wishes to do so, it does not yet follow that he is ready to join the band of helpers. Most people at this stage are so wrapped up in their own train of thought, usually a continuation of some line taken up in waking hours, that they are like a man in a brown study, so much absorbed as to be practically entirely heedless of all that is going on about them. And in many ways it is well that this is so, for there is much upon the astral plane which might be unnerving and terrifying to one who had not the courage born of full knowledge as to the real nature of all that he would see. Sometimes a man gradually rouses himself out of this condition, wakes up to the astral world around him, as it were, but more often he remains in that state until someone who is already active that takes him in hand and wakens him. This is, however, not a responsibility to be lightly undertaken, for while it is comparatively easy thus to wake a man up on the astral plane, it is practically impossible, except by a most undesirable exercise of mesmeric influence, to put him to sleep again. So that before a member of the band of workers will thus awaken a dreamer, he must fully satisfy himself that the man's disposition is such that he will make good use of the additional powers that will then be put into his hands, and also that his knowledge and his courage are sufficient to make it reasonably certain that no harm will come to him as a result of the action. Such awakening so performed will put a man in a position to join if he will the band of those who help mankind. But it must be clearly understood that this does not necessarily or even usually bring with it the power of remembering in the waking consciousness anything which has been done. That capacity has to be attained by the man for himself, and in most cases it does not come for years afterwards, perhaps not even in the same life. But happily this lack of memory in the body in no way impedes the work out of the body, so that, except for the satisfaction to a man of knowing during his waking hours upon what work he has been engaged during his sleep, it is not a matter of importance. What really matters is that the work should be done, not that we should remember who did it. Chapter 6. A timely intervention. Varied as is this work on the astral plane, it is all directed to one great end, the furtherance, in however humble a degree, of the processes of evolution. Occasionally it is connected with the development of the lower kingdoms, which it is possible slightly to accelerate under certain conditions. A duty towards these lower kingdoms, elemental as well as animal and vegetable, is distinctly recognized by adept leaders, since it is in some cases only through connection with or use by man that their progress takes place. But naturally by far the largest and most important part of the work is connected with humanity in some way or other. The services rendered are of many and various kinds, but chiefly concerned with man's spiritual development, such physical interventions as are recounted in the earlier part of this book being exceedingly rare. They do, however, occasionally take place, and though it is my wish to emphasize rather the possibility of extending mental and moral help to our fellow men, it will perhaps be well to give two or three instances in which friends personally known to me have rendered physical assistance to those in sore need of it, in order that it may be seen how these examples from the experience of the helpers gear in with the accounts given by those who have received the supernormal aid, such stories, I mean, as those which are to be found in the literature of so-called supernatural occurrences. In the course of the recent rebellion in Matabeleland, one of our members was sent upon an errand of mercy which may serve as an illustration of the way in which help upon this lower plane has occasionally been given. It seems that one night a certain farmer and his family in that country were sleeping tranquilly in fancied security, quite unaware that only a few miles away relentless hordes of savage foes were lying in ambush maturing fiendish plots of murder and rapine. Our member's business was in some way or other to arouse the sleeping family to a sense of the terrible danger which so unexpectedly menaced them, and she found this by no means an easy matter. An attempt to impress the idea of imminent peril upon the brain of the farmer failed utterly, and as the urgency of the case seemed to demand strong measures, our friend decided to materialize herself sufficiently to shake the housewife by the shoulder and adjure her to get up and look about her. The moment she saw that she had been successful in attracting attention, she vanished, And the farmer's wife has never from that day to this been able to find out which of her neighbors it was who roused her so opportunely, and thus saved the lives of the entire family, who but for this mysterious intervention would undoubtedly have been massacred in their beds half an hour later. Nor can she even now understand how this friend in need contrived to make her way in, when all the windows and doors were found so securely barred. Being this abruptly awakened, the housewife was half inclined to consider the warning a mere dream. However, she arose and looked around just to see that all was right, and fortunate it was that she did so, for though she found nothing amiss indoors, she had no sooner thrown open a shutter than she saw the sky red with a distant conflagration. She at once roused her husband and the rest of the family, and owing to this timely notice they were able to escape to a place of concealment near at hand just before the arrival of the horde of savages, who destroyed the house and ravaged the fields indeed, but were disappointed of the human prey which they had expected. The feelings of the rescuer may be imagined when she read in the newspaper some time afterwards an account of the providential deliverance of this family. Chapter 7. There. Angel Story. Another instance of intervention on the physical plane which occurred a short time ago makes a very beautiful little story, though this time only one life was saved. It needs, however, a few words of preliminary explanation. Among our band of helpers here in Europe are two who were brothers long ago in ancient Egypt, and are still warmly attached to one another. In this present incarnation there is a wide difference in age between them, one being advanced in middle life, while the other was at that time a mere child in the physical body, though an ego of considerable advancement and promise. Naturally it falls to the lot of the elder to train and guide the younger in the occult work to which they are so heartily devoted. And as both are fully conscious and active on the astral plane, they spend most of the time during which their grosser bodies are asleep in laboring together under the direction of their common master, and giving to both living and dead such help as is within their power. I will quote the story of the particular incident which I wish to relate from a letter written by the elder of the two helpers immediately after its occurrence, as the description the given is more vivid and picturesque than any account in the third person could possibly be. We were going about quite other business, when Cyril suddenly cried, "What's that?" For we heard a terrible scream of pain or fright. In a moment we were on the spot, and found that a boy of about 11 or 12 had fallen over a cliff onto some rocks below, and was very badly hurt. He had broken a leg and an arm, poor fellow, but what was still worse was a dreadful cut in the thigh, from which blood was pouring in a torrent. Cyril cried, "Let us help him quick, or he'll die." In emergencies of this kind one has to think quickly. There were clearly two things to be done: that bleeding must be stopped, and physical help must be procured. I was obliged to materialize either Cyril or myself, for we wanted physical hands at once to tie a bandage, and besides it seemed better that the poor boy should see someone standing by him in his trouble. I felt that while undoubtedly he would be more at home with Cyril than with me, I should probably be more readily able to procure help than Cyril would, so the division of labor was obvious. The plan worked capitally. I materialized Cyril instantly. He does not know yet how to do it for himself, and told him to take the boy's neckerchief and tie it round the thigh, and twist a stick through it. It hurt him terribly, said Cyril, but he did it, and the blood stopped flowing. The injured boy seemed half unconscious, and could scarcely speak, but he looked up at the shining little form bending so anxiously over him, and asked, "Be you an angel, master?" Cyril smiled so prettily, and replied, "No, I'm only a boy. But I've come to help you." And then I left him to comfort the sufferer while I rushed off to the boy's mother, who lived about a mile away. The trouble I had to force into that woman's head, the conviction that something was wrong, and that she must go and see about it, you would never believe, but at last she threw down the pan she was cleaning, and said aloud, "Well, I know what's come over me, but I must go and find the boy." When she once started I was able to guide her without much difficulty, though at the time I was holding Cyril together by willpower, lest the poor child's angel should suddenly vanish from before his eyes. Don't you see, when you materialize a form you are changing matter from its natural state into another, temporarily opposing the cosmic will, as it were, and if you take your mind off it for one half second, back it flies into its original condition like a flash of lightning. So I could not give more than half my attention to that woman, but still I got her along somehow, and as soon as she came round the corner of the cliff I let Cyril disappear, but she had seen him, and now the village has one of the best attested stories of angelic intervention on record. The accident happened in the early morning, and the same evening I looked in, astrally, upon the family to see how matters were going on. The poor boy's leg and arm had been set, and the great cut bandaged, and he lay in bed looking very pale and weak, but evidently going to recover in time. The mother had a couple of neighbors in, and was telling them the story, and a curious tale it sounded to one who knew the real facts. She explained, in very many words, how she couldn't tell what it was, but something came over her all in a minute like, making her feel something had happened to the boy, and she must go out and see after him. How at first she thought it was nonsense, and tried to throw off the feeling. But it warned.t no use, she just had to go. She told how she didn't.t know what made her go round by that cliff more than any other way, but it just happened so, and as she turned round the corner there she saw him lying propped up against a rock, and kneeling beside him was there. Beautifulest child ever she saw, dressed all in white and shining, with rosy cheeks and lovely brown eyes. And how he smiled at her. So heavenly like. And then all in a moment he was not there, and at first she was so startled she didn't know what to think, and then all at once she felt what it was, and fell on her knees and thanked God for sending one of his angels to help her poor boy. Then she told how when she lifted him to carry him home she wanted to take off the handkerchief that was cutting into his poor leg so, but he would not let her, because he said the angel had tied it and said he was not to touch it, and how when she told the doctor this afterwards he explained to her that if she had unfastened it the boy would certainly have died. Then she repeated the boy's part of the tale, how the moment after he fell this lovely little angel came to him, he knew it was an angel because he knew there had been nobody in sight for half a mile round when he was at the top of the cliff just before, only he could not understand why it hadn't any wings, and why it said it was only a boy, how it lifted him against the rock and tied up his leg, and then began to talk to him and tell him he need not be frightened, because somebody was gone to fetch mother, and she would be there directly, how it kissed him and tried to make him comfortable, and how its soft, warm, little hand held his all the time, while it told him strange, beautiful stories which he could not clearly remember, but he knew they were very good, because he had almost forgotten he was hurt until he saw his mother coming, and how then it assured him he would soon be well again, and smiled and squeezed his hand. And then somehow it was gone. Since then there has been quite a religious revival in that village. Their minister has told them that so signal an interposition of divine providence must have been meant as a sign to them, to rebuke scoffers and to prove the truth of Holy Scripture and of the Christian religion, and nobody seems to see the colossal conceit involved in such an astonishing proposition. But the effect on the boy had been undoubtedly good, morally as well as physically. By all accounts he was a careless enough young scamp before, but now he feels his angel may be near him at any time, and he will never do or say anything rough or coarse or angry, lest it should see or hear. The one great desire of his life is that some day he may see it again, and he knows that when he dies its lovely face will be the first to greet him on the other side. A beautiful and pathetic little story, truly. The moral drawn from the occurrence by the village and its minister is perhaps somewhat of a non sequitur, yet the testimony to the existence of at least something beyond this material plane must surely do the people more good than harm, and after all the mother's conclusion from what she saw was a perfectly correct one, though more accurate knowledge would probably have led her to express it a little differently. An interesting fact afterwards discovered by the investigations of the writer of the letter throws a curious sidelight upon the reasons underlying such incidents. It was found that the two boys had met before, and that some thousands of years ago the one who fell from the cliff had been the slave of the other, and had once saved his young master's life at the risk of his own, and had been liberated in consequence. And now, long afterwards, the master not only repays the debt in kind, but also gives his former slave a high ideal and an inducement to morality of life which will probably change the whole course of his future evolution. So true is it that no good deed ever goes unrewarded by karma, however tardy it may seem in its action, that though the mills of God grind slowly, yet they grind exceeding small. Though with patience stands he waiting, with exactness grinds he all. Chapter 8. The Story of a Fire. Another piece of work done by the same boy Cyril furnishes an almost exact parallel to some of the stories from the books which I had given in earlier pages. He and his older friend, it seems, were passing along in the prosecution of their usual work one night, when they noticed the fierce glare of a big fire below them, and promptly dived down to see if they could be of any use. It was a great hotel which was in flames, a huge caravanserai on the edge of a great lake. The house, many stories in height, formed three sides of a square round a sort of garden, planted with trees and flowers, while the lake formed the fourth side. The two wings ran right down to the lake, the big bay windows which terminated them almost projecting over the water, so as to leave only quite a narrow passageway under them at the two sides. The front and wings were built round inside wells, which contained also the latticework shafts of the lifts, so that when once the fire broke out, it spread with almost incredible rapidity, and before our friends saw it on their astral journey all the middle floors in each of the three great blocks were in flames. Fortunately the inmates, except one little boy, had already been rescued, though some of them had sustained very serious burns and other injuries. This little fellow had been forgotten in one of the upper rooms of the left wing, for his parents were out at a ball, and knew nothing of the fire, while naturally enough no one else thought of the lad till it was far too late. The fire had gained such a hold on the middle floors of that wing that nothing could have been done, even if anyone had remembered him, as his room faced on to the inner garden which has been mentioned, so that he was completely cut off from all outside help. Besides, he was not even aware of his danger, for the dense, suffocating smoke had so gradually filled the room that his sleep had grown deeper and deeper, till he was all but stupefied. In this state he was discovered by Cyril, who seems to be specially attracted towards children in need or danger. He first tried to make some of the people remember the boy, but in vain, and in any case it seemed scarcely possible that they could have helped him, so that it was soon evident that this was merely a waste of time. The older helper then materialized, Cyril, as before, in the room, and set him to work to awaken and rouse up the more than half-stupefied child. After a good deal of difficulty this was accomplished to some extent, but the boy remained in a half-dazed, semi-conscious condition through all that followed, so that he needed to be pushed and pulled about, guided and helped at every turn. The two boys first crept out of the room into the central passage which ran through the wing, and then, finding that the smoke and the flames beginning to come through the floor made it impassable for a physical body, Cyril got the other boy back into the room again and out of the window onto a stone ledge, about a foot wide, which ran right along the block just below the windows. Along this he managed to guide his companion, half balancing himself on the extreme edge of the ledge, and half floating on air, but always placing himself outside of the other, so as to keep him from dizziness and prevent him from feeling afraid of a fall. Towards the end of the block nearest the lake, in which direction the fire seemed less developed, they climbed in through an open window and again reached the passage, hoping to find the staircase at that end still passable. But it, too, was full of flame and smoke, so they crawled back along the passage, Cyril advising his companion to keep his mouth close to the ground, till they reached the latticed cage of the lift running down the long well in the center of the block. The lift, of course, was at the bottom, but they managed to clamber down the latticework inside the cage till they stood on the roof of the elevator itself. Here they found themselves blocked, but luckily Cyril discovered a doorway opening from the cage of the lift onto a sort of entresol just above the ground floor.